All right, let's see. A healthy dose of the global economy, a trend to keep an eye on here as well, softball, and video games to boot. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, the 21st of June. Good as always to have you here, everybody. Politics, yes, there is plenty of that today. See also speeches and or tweets by Trump, Donald, and Clinton, Hillary. There is macroeconomics, too. Yellen, Janet, and her testimony, congressional. But indulge me for a minute here with a topic that will be of great concern to whoever wins the election this fall and whoever chairs the Fed for them. Labor force, men. The people that labor economists refer to as prime working age men, ages 25 to 54, and how they are just not in the labor force the way they used to be. A report out from the White House says that somewhere between 11 and 12% of those men aren't even looking for jobs and so aren't counted in unemployment rates. Marketplace's Lewis Wallace explores whether perhaps we have reached peak men.
Turns out peak men is so last century. I asked Georgetown economist Harry Holzer about it.
So when did we reach peak men in the labor force?
In the mid-1950s.
Wow.
Yeah, back then a whopping 98% of these prime age guys were working or looking for work. Today it's 88%. And
the declines have been much bigger among black men and among less educated men.
Holzer says flat or declining wages are a big factor. So is the skills gap. Folks aren't getting linked up with the right kind of education to get well-paid jobs. Carlton Kuntz helps young people find jobs in Durham, North Carolina. That's one of the states with the lowest overall labor force participation. He says it's easy for people in areas of concentrated poverty to get disconnected.
If you don't know these resources are out there, you're thinking, well, hey, there's nothing out there for me, but McDonald's.
And it's easy to lose hope. The White House report argues high incarceration rates also play a role. Brian Stevenson heads the nonprofit Equal Justice Initiative in Alabama. He says there are at least 70 million people in the U.S. with criminal records.
There are very significant barriers to reemployment when you are formerly incarcerated.
The White House suggests a bunch of changes to address all this, including criminal justice reform. By the way, no surprise, more women are working today than they were in the 1950s, but that's not a driving force behind men dropping out. I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
You know how every time government dietary recommendations are revised, it's a big deal, food pyramid and all that? Same thing in China. There are new guidelines over there, and the Guardian newspaper reports that they include cutting meat consumption in China by half, which makes this, in that way that the global economy works, a climate change story. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Jed Kim tells us what's going on.
How much would a Chinese cutback on meat consumption affect the U.S.? Well, first of all, realize we're talking mainly about pork. China's banned U.S. beef for about a dozen years now after a mad cow scare. Besides that, China's pork industry is just
massive. That country produces and consumes about half the world's pork.
Joe Sheely is with the U.S. Meat Export Federation. He says the Chinese appetite for pork is so large it can still need imports. Already through April of this year, the U.S. has shipped about $220 million worth to the mainland. So a cutback could be significant. But Sheely says sales will probably stay strong.
You're going to still add new users because more and more people in China move into the middle class each year. More of them have access to modern supermarkets, modern restaurants, that kind of thing.
There is hope among environmental groups that a cutback would significantly reduce carbon emissions from the Chinese livestock industry. UC Davis's Frank Mitlerner is used to dashing those hopes. He's argued against estimates that livestock contributes up to half the world's greenhouse gas emissions. Mitlerner says it's much lower. But he also agrees the Chinese will keep eating more meat.
The reason why this recommendation comes up, in my opinion, is that they are fearful that they cannot satisfy that need.
If that's the case, it could mean more boom years for U.S. exports. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
I mentioned Janet Yellen's testimony, congressional. A difference, it didn't make on Wall Street. Okay, that was one too far. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We'll be right back. 48 hours plus or minus and counting until the referendum over in the UK about whether to stay or whether to get out of the European Union. Economy-wise, it's either going to be another Y2K, nothing to see here, let's all move along, or it will be quite the opposite. For global markets, currencies, stocks, and others, it's the not knowing that's the big deal. Nowhere more so than actually in London, the city of London, the UK's financial center. Theo Leggett is just the man to talk to about this. He's a business correspondent with the BBC. Theo, it's good to speak with you.
Good to speak to you too, Kai.
As one walks the streets of the city, the financial district over in London, what do you hear, first of all? What's the buzz? What's the chatter?
Well, it's all getting very tense because people in the City of London, they would love to know what the result in this very closely fought referendum is going to be, but they're no better informed than anybody else. So the banks in particular, they're putting in place their preparations for what looks like it'll be a very busy night on Thursday.
Are they going to, they'll be actively trading and working, right, as these numbers come in?
Yes, absolutely. The banks are particularly concerned that if there are big moves on sterling, and they think that there will be, they don't get caught out. So, for example, their IT teams will be on full alert so that electronic trades all go smoothly, because they are expecting some drama. I was speaking to one senior foreign exchange strategist earlier on who said that if the UK decides to leave the European Union, we can expect sterling to fall very hard indeed over a short period of time. And obviously, if the UK votes to remain in the European Union, it could just as easily go the other way.
Is it true that some of these banks and hedge funds have commissioned their own private polls, right, because there's no public polling being done?
Well, they're certainly picking up their own private information. What they're getting is less clear. There are no official exit polls being done in this referendum. And I've been speaking to pollsters about this, and they say, well, what they do think people are doing and what various research agencies have told me is happening is that various institutions like hedge funds are coming to them and getting some private information. So telephone polling, that kind of thing. But they can do it until very late in the day. So if you're a hedge fund and you think there are going to be big moves on sterling, you want to know as late in the day if there's a sudden swing or anything like that.
It's worth a mention here, Theo, that when the sun comes up in London Friday morning and the results are more or less clear, while the currency trading and the stocks and all of that will be, volatile, I guess, nothing structural changes that day.
No, the UK will remain a member of the European Union, and for a considerable period of time. The British government has to go to other European countries and say, we want to leave, and that would kick off a two-year negotiating period, during which it would be expected to agree the terms of leaving the European Union. So what its trading relationship with the rest of Europe would be and so on. So no, there would be no overnight change. That said, it would be clear that there would be uncertainties if Britain were to leave the European Union. And that's why we'd see such volatility on the financial markets.
Uncertainty, of course, in economic terms, right? I mean, setting aside the vote, we just don't know what would happen.
Absolutely, yes. The people who want to leave the European Union say there may be bad effects if we leave in some areas, but overall, Britain would be better off outside the European Union. But what we are seeing here is uncertainty, and uncertainty moves markets.
That's my favorite word of late, uncertainty. Theo Leggett from our partner broadcasters, the BBC in London. Thank you, Theo.
Always a pleasure, Kai.
Summertime for a lot of people means being outdoors, recreating, playing sports, joining leagues, playing competitively sometimes. For women, though, once you get beyond those rec leagues, options are scarce. There is basketball, that's true, but back in the day, it was softball, first co-ed, and then strictly women's leagues when company-sponsored teams toured the country. Erica Westley tells the history and maybe the future of women's softball in her new book, Fast Pitch, it's called. Erica, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you. Happy to be here.
It had to be company teams, right? Because it's not like there was a league, was there?
Right. Softball was very much an amateur sport in that time, and all the teams were sponsored by local companies and local businesses. And there were hundreds of thousands of these teams across the country. So softball was really crucial for female athletes at that time. It was a crucial opportunity for them to play sports competitively.
What happened then between the time when it was so big or as big as it is or as it was back then and sort of now when it's big, but in a different kind of way, right? It's big in college and high school, but not so much with people actually getting paid for it.
Right. Well, the main thing that happened was that the men dropped away from the game. And as it became more of a women's only sport, it became more marginalized. And the other factor was that a lot of those companies, you know, it was never profitable to sponsor these teams. Right. And eventually by the 1970s, they just weren't sponsoring them anymore.
A lot of the people who are listening to this probably remember fast pitch women's softball for a negative event, really, the fact that the Olympics have taken it out of competition. Tell me why that matters just in the bigger economic picture.
Yes, I hope that people remember that. And hopefully softball will be back in the Olympics for 2020, which is very exciting. But it was voted off, which was really an unprecedented occurrence in 2005. No Olympic sport had been eliminated from the Olympic program up to that point, at least not since the 1930s when the Olympics were kind of still getting formed. So it was a big deal when both softball and baseball were eliminated together.
Baseball, you can't be too worried about, right? But softball, you know, gets axed from the Olympics. And then I imagine sort of national softball federations don't spend as much because there's nowhere for these women to go. Colleges are, you know, they don't have that promise of things for their women to do, right?
Right, exactly. It was a big hit, especially internationally. In the U.S., the college game has continued to grow almost exponentially. And it's a big hit for the college players, too, because a lot of the young women, having watched Jenny Finch and the other players compete in the Olympics, they had kind of grown up dreaming of that goal, and then to have it taken away once they were teenagers was really hard for them.
Yeah. But it's funny now. I mean, I can go home on a summer afternoon and my teenage boys who, you know, probably should be out mowing the lawn or whatever, are sitting there watching women's college softball on ESPN. It's kind of wild, actually.
Yeah, ESPN, it's one of their most popular college sports that they show, and the tournament's hugely popular. And I think the only caveat is that it ends there. You know, these are just the college players, and there's not that outlet to see these players improve as they get older.
Did you play softball when you were a kid?
I didn't. I've never played softball, actually.
Huh. So where did this book come from?
Well, I grew up watching baseball. My dad is a huge baseball fan. So I grew up with the knowledge of baseball and then happened upon the college tournament on ESPN as an adult, the college softball tournament.
Yeah.
I liked it. I actually prefer watching fast pitch, but I'm as surprised as anyone that I wound up writing a book about softball.
It's a good one. It's interesting. It's called Fast Pitch, The Untold History of Softball and the Women Who Played the Game by Erica Wesley. Erica, thanks very much.
No, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Coming up.
But what you said was and. You didn't say or.
Video games, big screen and small. Or, first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 24 points. Today, about a 10%, 17,829. The NASDAQ added 6 points, a 10%, 4843. The S&P 500 gained 5 points, 0.2%, finished at 2,088. American Axle and Manufacturing Holdings, which, among other things, makes axles, was downgraded by Bank of America. American Axle down nearly 6% today. Metaldyne Performance Group, another drivetrain maker, got dinged by Bank of America as well. Metaldyne off 5.7%. Hister Yale Materials Handling, it's in the forklift business, in case you didn't know. Lowered shares 1.1%. Wabash National Corporation, which makes truck and tank trailers, fell 5.4% today. So all of that said, a bad day for the trucking industry after several freight companies reported lower than expected earnings. Swift Transportation off 6.8% today. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The beauty of elections is that no matter what the polls say, a good part of the time you don't really know how they're going to turn out, which means every vote counts. That helps explain why the 23,000 votes to be cast in the tiny British territory of Gibraltar are very much in play in the Brexit referendum. Gibraltar and the rock of the same name overlook the strait of the same name between the Atlantic Ocean and the Mediterranean Sea and are firmly connected to the Spanish mainland, wherein lies the problem. The BBC's Guy Hedgecoe reports.
I'm on the Spanish side of the border, and I can see the famous Rock of Gibraltar towering over the British territory below. Gibraltar's position, which is perched right next to the Mediterranean Sea, has made it a place of huge strategic importance over the centuries for the UK. Right now, there's a long queue of cars here, of people waiting to cross over into Gibraltar. Now, some of these are Spaniards going to work there. Others are among the millions of tourists who visit Gibraltar each year. And there are also some local Gibraltar residents returning from a visit to the Spanish side of the border.
Sentry! Halt!
Across the border, the changing of the military guard outside the government headquarters is a noisy reminder that Gibraltar has been part of Britain for three centuries. There are plenty of other reminders too. There's a street called Winston Churchill Avenue. There are British pubs, shops and banks, and even old-fashioned red British telephone booths. And yet, when it comes to the issue of the referendum on EU membership, Gibraltarians think differently to many of their fellow Britons.
How are you going to vote in the referendum?
Most definitely to remain, and I'll convince as many people about doing the same thing. If Britain leaves, in all likelihood, Gibraltar will have a huge trauma.
I will vote in, of course.
You say of course. Why of course?
Because obviously it's going to be the best for Gibraltar. Because otherwise Spain, I think they will invade as much as they can.
I am going to vote to stay in. Because our major concern is the political side from the harassment that we'll get from Spain.
Many Gibraltar residents expressed similar fears about how Spain might behave if Britain left the EU. Madrid has long contested British ownership of the Rock, and the Spanish foreign minister said recently that if there was a Brexit, then the very next day his government would start pushing for talks about Gibraltar's sovereignty. A recent poll said that nearly 90% of Gibraltarians will vote to remain in the Union. But Joe Garcia, a retired businessman, has agonised over the decision more than most people.
I'm going to vote to remain, but I'm doing so with gritted teeth, primarily because I don't really want to belong to a club where Spain is a member. I think the majority of my fellow Gibraltarians will vote to remain within the EU, purely because the EU defends us.
For him and many others, memories of when Spain closed the border with Gibraltar for 16 years in the 1970s and 80s are still painfully fresh, and they believe the EU can prevent that from happening again. What's really striking in Gibraltar, where unemployment is close to zero and taxes are famously low, is how few people make the economic argument for staying in the EU. But for one man, who I meet in the corner of a tea room, it's absolutely crucial.
My name's Fabian Picardo. I'm the leader of the Gibraltar Socialist Labour Party and the current Chief Minister of Gibraltar. The single European market of 520 million people is a very important characteristic to us of what the European Union offers, because, of course, we're a small place. We're 30,000 people. Gibraltar's business is to sell services into the single market. And having a single market means we don't have barriers to trade with those 500 million people. Our economic model today, our prosperity today, is based on having access to that market.
If Britain left the EU, what would happen? What would that mean to you?
Well, look, I think economically it's very challenging. It means that we have to recast our economic model. In the short and medium term, there would immediately be a very challenging time for Gibraltar.
So while most Gibraltarians seem to know their mind ahead of the referendum, come June the 23rd, they'll be as nervous as anyone about the result.
The BBC's Guy Hedgeko in Gibraltar for us.
L.A. last week was the center of the electronic gaming universe. Electronic Entertainment, technically, the Electronic Entertainment Expo E3 was in town. Everybody who's anybody in that world was here, and there are few bigger in that world than EA, Electronic Arts. You know them from FIFA and Madden and Star Wars Battlefront, also the Battlefield franchise. 41-year-old CEO Andrew Wilson is in charge. He's been at the company for a bit more than 15 years, CEO for three, and he is today's guest on Conversations from the Corner Office.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
The company set up a big space for people to try out some of their new, not yet released to the public games. The best part was, it's just a couple of blocks from Marketplace World headquarters. So I got a tour from the boss, CEO Andrew Wilson.
And so we've got it themed, basically, so that you can come in, and this is, you know, Battlefield 1. We've got 64 stations playing games. People come in, they play, they compete.
So this is just rows and rows and rows of people playing Battlefield 1?
Yeah. Together.
Together.
You know, the important thing is this is not a solo endeavor. This is not me escaping the world. This is me connecting with my friends through a different world.
The way you have brought this company back is this thing you're called Players First, right?
Yeah.
What does that mean? And how'd you lose your way is actually a better question to start with.
Yeah, so when you're in a creative industry, you can get very precious about what it is that you're building. And I think in some places, we were coming to work every day trying to do amazing things, but forgetting who it was we were doing it for. And all we did when we came back together was say, hey, let's think about the players first. What might they want? What might enhance their lives? What might make it better for them to connect with their friends? And it really, we galvanized around that, and the company's a different company as a result.
You know, you mentioned connecting with your friends. It sort of sounds like you think of this as a little bit as a social media company, kind of.
Well, there are a whole bunch of motivations as to why we play games. Inspiration, escape, competition. But the very core of why we play games is social connection. When people come to play one of our games, they become part of a community. They share something with their friends. They compete against them. They compete with them. They enjoy the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat. And that's a pretty special thing. And if you look at the way our players enjoy our games, it's always done with their friends.
Let me posit a potential customer problem for you, right? I've got an 8-year-old daughter who can play Star Wars Battlefront for hours.
Yes.
Truly, right?
Yep.
When I let her do it. She can also pull out my iPhone and play games on that for hours as well. How do you cater to both of those audiences without cannibalizing one over the other?
The misnomer is that one will cannibalize the other. I can watch TV on my phone, but when I'm sitting in my living room in front of a 60-inch TV, I don't watch it on my phone. I watch it on the big screen.
Yeah, see, now my kids do. Maybe you're a little old for this job. You know what I mean? Because my kids literally will sit there with a phone and with the big screen.
Yeah, but what you said was and. You didn't say or.
Well, there you go.
What you said was and. And so what we see is not that the mobile device is cannibalizing HD gaming. What we see is mobile devices enhancing and extending HD gaming. And some people will play on a big screen only. Some people will play on a mobile device only. Some people will play on both. We are building for a future where every device you own, your phone, your PC, your TV, your internet-enabled fridge, will deliver you some form of interactive entertainment. And we're building for a world where players play across devices, across geographies, and across business models.
What's your favorite game ever, all time?
Probably California Games was this crazy little game that I used to play on my Commodore 64 when I was a kid.
Wow.
But it had surfing, skateboarding, hacky sack. And again, if I went back and played it now, it would just be the dumbest
game
ever.
It'd be horrible. You wouldn't be able to
do it. I mean,
it would
be absolute rubbish. But at that moment, I mean, we would go surf. I grew up in a beach town. I'd go surfing with my friends, and we'd come home, and we'd sit there and have, like, California Games competition. So I have this memory of this time with some of the greatest friends in my life playing this game, this super simple game, but a game that related to what we did in real life, you know, skateboarding and surfing. And I've kind of held on to that. That is kind of the essence of what we do.
Andrew, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having
really
me.
Really appreciate it. How do I move around?
So this is Ford.
Yep. How do I aim this gun? Oh, yeah. The armored car ran over me, and I just blew up.
I'm being shot at right now from your right.
How do I know? All right, but I'm not going anywhere. Now tell me one more time how to go forward. Yeah, and this is why my 8-year-old beats me all the time. Totally harder than it looks, by the way. Let me just say that. We've got to get really meta about it. A quick little video of me playing that video game. It's at marketplace.org. And if you want to hear the rest of my conversation with Andrew Wilson, the CEO of Electronic Arts, we've got it on the latest version of our Corner Office podcast. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. It's up to you. This final note on the way out today, input on possibly the most seismic decision in the global economy in a generation, perhaps. Elizabeth Hurley, actress and model, tweeted out a picture of a butterfly in Union Jack colors escaping the EU box the other day. So she, mark it down, is a leave vote. David Beckham, international soccer star, also, by the way, a model, is a remain vote based on his Twitter feed. Of course, back here, Jose Canseco, late of the steroid era in Major League Baseball, tweeted this, among other things, today. If there is a Brexit, he said, quote, capital will flee the UK like its pants are on fire. End of quote. I report, you decide. In all honesty, Jose Canseco's Twitter feed, totally entertaining. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 24 points today, a 10%. The NASDAQ up 6 points, a 10%. The S&P 500, 5 points higher, 0.2%. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kerwa, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. Whole new show. Like every day, a whole new show.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.